Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Egyptian crisis rolls on. Bernanke says, absolutely not. There's no inflation here. I don't see anything. The earnings numbers are looking pretty strong. And when it comes to employment, we drop down to 9%. And things are looking good, aren't they? Well, we'll get to the bottom of some of the weather issues and some of the things that are going on with regard to the employment numbers and how they look internally. We have two different guests here today. We have Barry Ritholtz from The Big Picture, as well as Frank Curzio, our good friend that started off today. That's all on this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 198. So what I thought we'd do today was we'll start right off with Frank Curzio, talking about a variety of topics of global importance, of course. We had him on before the beginning of the year. And, you know, if you ever look at the iTunes section of podcasts and you go down to find out where the Disciplined Investor Podcast is, if you look at any of the comments, you'll see, hey, I really love the show, all this good stuff. And then especially when Frank Curzio is on. So, hey, Frankie.
What's going on,
boys? How are you? Everything's good. I thought that we would start off with a discussion about the kind of environment that we're in right now when it comes to investing. You know, animal spirits are words we've heard before. And we've heard bullish sentiment, of course. You know, Doug Kass says he's out of the market. This guy says it's topped out. DeMarc says, hey, there's going to be a big correction coming. None of it happens. We have a dip of 50 basis points in the market during a day, and it's immediately turned around and brought back up. Point, though, is what is it right now in terms of what investors believe is going on and how they're not affected with things like Egypt and all that? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't know. I have thoughts on Doug Kass. I mean, I thought he was out of the market like 9 months ago.
Yeah, but then he sneaks in and out and kind of tells you like he's long gold once gold starts moving up, I think. I don't know. It's very confusing.
Listen, I think these guys are actually right. I'm just joking. And I used to write on street.com and you know, talk to Doug Kass sometimes. But it's a risky environment right now. It's really crazy, especially talking from a guy who recommends under 10 stocks where – you know, we've had some big winners in a portfolio and, you know, 2 days later, 3 days later, they'll decline 20% on no news. I mean, some of these stocks are up 75-80% for us, but that would decline and for no reason at all. So there's a ton of risk out there. And I think we have to look at where we came from. So, you know, where we came from, okay, fine. You know, the market was terrible. I think we had to readjust. Everybody was nervous, but then we saw the economic indicators getting much better. And you couldn't deny that, even if you're a bear.
Right.
So, but now where we are in the marketplace, where we are, where we're going in the future, we're not going to see these enormous gains. I think it's going to be a very choppy market. It's going to be very risky. One of the stocks that we both know is called Power One, I believe. And it just got crushed today. But yeah, it's up tremendously. You know, so you got to give people credit. But still, I saw people recommend the stock at 7. It went to 11 and it gets completely crushed. So you really have to be careful. Guys, you have to focus on balance sheets. Focus on ways to limit risk, and I guess to limit risk, pick stocks that people hate, like that analysts don't like right now, that have had a bad quarter, that have come down 30%. You know why? Because you're going to have limited risk there if they have a good balance sheet, if they had a terrible quarter. You know, you're seeing the stock down already. All they need is a little bit of good news, and those stocks can really take off. But if you're going to buy those high flyers that are up so high and you know that are up 800%, 300%, 200% over the past year, Just know all you need is a little bit of bad news and they're done. And not only that, if we do see a market correction, these guys are going to get hit the hardest.
You know, it's interesting. Power One, we as part of full disclosure, we had a small position of Power One. And this is the second time we actually entered the stock. The first time we entered the stock, we were very pleased. We made some money on it. It went up. I think we made some money on it. I'm trying to remember because it was a strange circumstance. The last time earnings came out and what happened was that the stock was up like 25% after the market during aftermarket hours. And then the next day it started coming back pretty strong and then ended down like 15% on that. Then it slowly started creeping up. It broke out of its range. We picked up a piece of it. It was up like
I don't know, 5-7%. And then all of a sudden, you're right, you know, they come out with, not only they come out with bad numbers, they come out with a real, they come out, actually, they beat numbers, and they came out okay, generally speaking, from this quarter, but they really had an outlook that was about $200 million lower than expectations. And the problem is that now, when we look at the stock, even though they do have, in my opinion, like you said, a good balance sheet, good numbers, good growth, all the good things that are going along with it, although you have to temper that with their outlook. The problem, though, is now, do you trust management at all? Because they put together two quarters of kind of screwy earnings.
Yeah, and that's why you're seeing such a sell-off today. I mean, once you lose that confidence of the street, you know, one quarter is okay. Okay, 3 months of business is bad. But when you're a growth company and you miss once, I mean, look at F5. That's okay. Next quarter is going to be huge for F5. So you want to see if that company does make their next quarter estimates. If they don't, you're going to see that stock really get crushed because everybody's going to give up on it. So, yeah, you have to keep that confidence.
Yeah. So when it comes to these other companies we've talked about, in terms of the companies beating earnings on one side of the street, economic numbers looking better on the other side of the street, you know, then we add in things like Yemen, Egypt, Middle Eastern tensions, inflation that may or not be in existence, depending on what side of the street you live on. You know, what's your take on that? I mean, why is it that we had a one-day move? Well, let me ask you this. The Friday before, where we saw that big takedown on the market, which supposedly was part of the scare about Egypt, we could probably say it had more to do with Amazon, Microsoft, and a few, and Ford for that matter, their earnings. And if we took Egypt out of the equation, nobody really would have known the difference.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'm fortunate enough to have a really good friend at the State Department, and he travels probably about 250,000 miles a year all over every place, all over the world. And he tells me this has been going on for a very long time. It's just been, you know, now it's just so inflated and CNN's covering it. And you're seeing so many people protest that that's such a big deal. But, you know, food prices, I mean, we don't really understand the, like, food prices. We say, wow, you know, we have to pay a higher bill. And, you know, we never think of like the world running out of food or anything.
Right.
But in fact, that's, you know, if you look at the math, that we're heading in that direction. Again, from the U.S., we're talking about a place that has the highest obesity rates. And, you know, we go to supermarkets filled with food. But other places, you know, if you think about it, if you're looking at population growth over the next 50 years, we're going to increase by something like 35%. And that's almost 2.8 billion people. Mm. Now, to put that in perspective, I mean, that's two Chinas, you know, that we're going to have. Now, it's not just feeding these people. These people need places to live. And what's happening is they're going to build more schools, more power plants, more homes. And when they do, they're building it on lands that produce – that land that produce crops. So, you know, when you're doing that and you're building on the arable land – not only are you going to have, you know, more people to feed, but you have less land to grow the food. And that's why you're seeing fertilizer companies go through the roof here. I mean, Potash, what is it, 180, 190? I mean, that stock keeps going higher. Monsanto. So you're seeing this, and I think if there's anything you could take from this, you know, from a macro perspective, I don't know how it's going to impact the market unless we see this happen in other places, Bangladesh, wherever. And other Arab nations, but I think you have to see what sectors are going to benefit the most off of it. And I think I'd be looking at fertilizer companies on a pullback because mm-hmm. they're up so high.
You know, you mentioned the whole idea of a pullback a second ago, and that people are looking at, you know, this at going after stocks that or looking at stocks that have a big pullback to get back in on, and that's really been the whole play in the last, I don't know, 3 months more than ever that I've seen it. That you see a pullback, maybe a terrible quarter or maybe a bad outlook. And it doesn't seem to matter because people just buy back into it. You know, you look at, you know, on the opposite side of the equation, you also see that, you know, when companies beat, they really move up nicely, et cetera. But it's almost an insatiable appetite for stocks, no matter how bad the current quarter is. The idea is that it will get better in the future and might as well buy it on the pullback. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I guess, but it's difficult to see how worse it's going to get. Oh, what is it? 72-73% of companies that reported beat earnings. They're able to pass on these high costs. You know, you're seeing it filter into the unemployment rate where the people who don't have jobs don't look like they're getting a job anytime soon. Forget about what the unemployment rate says. Just, you know, so from an earnings standpoint, it seems like they're putting out the numbers. They're still beating Wall Street estimates. It's going to see how this continues because, you know, we've talked about this for what, like 2 years, how, you know, these higher costs, at least 18 months, how, you know, the companies are able to pass off these higher costs, but eventually there's going to be a point where they can't. We're not there yet. Maybe it's 6 months out, maybe it's 9 months out. And when that happens and we have a really terrible earnings season, look out because, you know, let's face it, that's the one factor that you can't deny. That's, I mean, we see economic data being, you know, much better, and a lot could be, you know, you could say, you know, quantitative easing. You know, it's from false measures. But the earnings have definitely been there. The balance sheets are stronger than ever. when you see earnings get hit, I think that's the time you're really, really going to see this market come down. But we haven't seen it this quarter, and who knows? We could see it next quarter.
But I'll tell you something, though. The reality is that Bernanke is and the quantitative easing, you know, you combine that with all the other things that have gone on, and the optimism is really there in the U.S. Now, what's also interesting is that the austerity measures that were taken, which is kind of the opposite, right? You know, the opposite of quantitative easing is the austerity. It doesn't seem to be affecting a lot of, well, Germany, clearly not, but it doesn't seem to be affecting the stock markets in those countries either. As a matter of fact, Europe is on a tear this year. You know, everybody thinks that things, I guess, are going to be fixed.
It's almost like our market, too. I mean, when you realize you're worried that the whole entire Europe is going to collapse, and then all of a sudden they stabilize, and you say, hey, you know what? They're going to be okay for a little while at least. You know, just like, I think we're going to be okay for a little while, but you can't tell me, you know, $1.4 trillion and rising, $1.5 trillion in deficits, it's going to hit the market eventually. We're, you know, you could say we're okay now, balance sheets are strong, but I think the same thing just happened with Europe where, you know, everyone said, okay, it's not the end of the euro yet, so let's see if we can make some money off of it.
Yeah, and then on the other hand, we have things like, you know, where you wouldn't expect, where the optimism should be is places like India and China and a few other emerging markets. Their economies are doing okay, but they're going into hyperinflation mode, and the Fed in their countries are pulling back. I mean, India is down like, I think, 17 or 18% this year.
Yeah, India's pulled back, China pulled back. If you want an interesting trend that I know you're not going to hear any place, look at Chinese reverse merger companies. Now, listen to me, though. A lot of companies, a ton of them, have come up through the reverse merger market, and today they're actually a lot of fantastic companies and a lot of ones that are terrible. Now, of course, they're going to highlight Herb Greenberg's on CNBC, pointing out to a couple of them that have done bad and pulling out things in their 10K. And, you know, it's easy to push these stocks down. But what hedge funds are doing is they're really, really shorting this market right now and telling these companies they're fraud, they're this, they're that. And they haven't even visited China. They know nothing about these companies. They're just hedge funds trying to make money, especially these small ones. And what's happening is these companies are getting crushed. And then they're going out and they're hiring the big four, like one of the big four auditors. And then the companies seem to be basing at those prices and then going back up again. So keep an eye on that trend. Believe me, if it's happened, I've seen like 10 to 15 companies do it and say, okay, if this is what we're going to have to do, even though most small caps in the U.S. don't even have big four accounting firms. But, you know, everybody, it's so easy to pick on these reverse hedge funds because it's so easy to say, hey, these guys are false because nobody really knows. So nobody goes to China. But you're pushing very, very good companies down. I think it's a good trend to keep an eye on them because you might be able to buy these for like a 30-40% discount and make a huge amount of money.
Well, and that 30-40% discount happens fast. So you got to keep some kind of a radar going because it could be in one day. There's a site called Money Waters, for example, that does some examination of this amongst others. And it's kind of like the reverse of the PR machine you see for small caps, right? Or for penny stocks, where they're trying to push them up. These are PR firms that are trying to actually, or maybe not PR firms, I shouldn't say that, but they're at least places that are looking to find fault. That's their job. You know, they're looking to find the negative in anything. And that really does, I agree, it does affect some of this. And, you know, but the whole reverse mortgage, it could also be called blind pools, gets them in to the U.S. markets in a much more efficient and inexpensive manner, right?
It's not illegal. Reverse mergers are not illegal. Right. That's what people have to understand. It's just that when you go the IPO route, people, you know, the investment firms hate it because they can't make money off of it. And if you want to look at the IPO route, look at a company called Concord Medical, China-based company that I actually visited, so the headquarters. They went the IPO route. And you know what? The stock opened up at 9. And you know, I talked to them, and the stock opened up at 9 and went all the way down to like 6. Over the first two quarters. And I think it came public in 2009. And I said, you know what? What happened? They said, you know, we were very uncomfortable, but the people who brought us public just inflated our estimates. And they make they're a great play on rising cancer rates in China. Guys, if you go to China, you can't even see the sun in some of these cities. That's how much air pollution. And they put these big machines in there where, you know, you monitor for cancer. And it takes like 2 years to actually, from the time you put it in and set up the hospitals that they place these machines in every single hospital in China to really earn revenue. Yet in the first 6 months, they had these revenue numbers totally inflated and the stock crashed. Nobody was saying anything about that, but everyone says, oh, you know, reverse mergers are terrible. Some of them, I mean, there are a ton of reverse mergers in these companies. You know, they'll change their name from Western Uranium to, you know, Joe Tablet because tablets are in today, you know? And we understand that. Yep. But you know, it's not illegal, and there's a lot of companies that are doing very, very well right now who've come from the reverse merger market. So just keep that in mind.
Yep. So we talk about a lot of times economic information with Frank because he makes it so clear. And I think, Frank, that's great. I think we also talk about some of the things that we scratch our heads about a lot of times, like going, what is that? You know? But here's a thing. I know that, you know, for Stansberry Research, you do a lot of writing. One of the things you've been writing about is the tablet market, which is clearly, by the way, do you have a tablet?
Yes, I have a tablet.
What do you have?
I have the iPad.
Okay, you like it?
Absolutely. I never thought it was given to me as a gift. I never thought in a million years how amazing it is. It's unbelievable. I use it all the time.
Because I also have gone to, all right, so you got it as a gift. That's nice. You know, I've gone a few times to the store with the intent to buy it. And for some reason, I just couldn't pull the trigger. Now, I realize I have the iPhone, so I figure, well, that's good enough. Although I have the new disease called iPhone arm. You know, I play a couple of games on there every once in a while with a few people, like this Words for Friends and all that. And, you know, you hold it in your right hand and all that. And I got this kind of iPhone arm going on where you get this pain in your elbow and a little bit of numbness and cold on the arm. It's really bad. But anyway, I've gone a few times. And, you know, they're not cheap. The iPads are not cheap. They're, what, $400, $500, $600, depending on what model you pick up.
Yep.
So I've always said at the time, oh, you know, what am I going to use it for? I use my laptop. I have my iPhone. So enlighten me into how you're using it.
I'll never use my laptop again.
Really?
I mean, that's because I do have, well, I have an office set up in my house that I use. And, you know, my business is writing. And if your business is writing, then, you know, you're not going to be able to use an iPad if you're writing 1,000-word pieces on a daily basis. But as far as just researching the internet, surfing, the games are amazing. Like, I'll be honest, I have a 3-year-old. Right? She's turning 3, my daughter Brianna, next week. I give her the iPad. She knows how to do things on it that I don't even know how to do. Flip the pages. She puts up an application. She listens to her favorite songs. And this is a 3-year-old. And I want to take a commercial of it. And I'm not like a big supporter of Apple all the time, their stock, and go buy the stock. I'm just telling you how the product is. When you buy one, you just, I'm telling you, I don't know one person who bought one who said, you know, this is a piece of garbage. I don't know why I did this. It's just, I don't know why it works. You think like, oh, I have a laptop. I don't need this. But when you get it, it's just, I don't know what it is. I have no idea.
Right,
it's
so,
almost
so,
like when kids pass McDonald's. They see McDonald's and they're like, oh my God, I got to go to McDonald's. Right. I don't know what happened. I don't know how they do
it. Right. That's genetically inbred, by the way. That's something standard. You know, that's part of the human being. McDonald's, you don't have to show them at McDonald's, explain what it is. But when they're born, they start pointing.
Exactly.
So, whether it's the Apple or iPad or whether it's the other tablets that are out there, you know, you have the Research of Motion, you have the big Samsung one, the Galaxy, I think it's called. You have a variety of them, obviously, on a couple different operating systems. Main one being the Android system, clearly the new Honeycomb coming out. You have a few different hardware players. From what aspect are you writing about this? Are you writing about the hardware plays or are you writing about the software or what?
Yeah, the hardware plays are the play here. I think this market is absolutely enormous. And the thing is, people are focusing on it in China. I think Apple has, whatever, 80, 90% market share. They were the first to come out, and that's going to change dramatically. But almost every single large cap technology company is getting into the tablet market over the next 12 months. Everyone I can think of. Anyone. So, but the story isn't in the U.S. The story is in China. They're just beginning to be sold in China. And people, you read so many reports how poor people in China are, or, you know, their per capita income and everything. Let me tell you something. 800 million people in China have a cell phone. Okay. Their savings rate is 40%. They have money. I don't know how much they make or whatever, but they save. And they're buying technology products. And, you know, if you look, even not even my estimates, but estimates from Wired are saying 100 million could be sold in 2011. Now, to really operate in China, it's not like who's the biggest, who's the best. You have to have relationships, and those relationships have to be established. So the companies I've been looking at have relationships with almost every supplier here, but also with the manufacturers in China. It's not too difficult to find, even though a lot of these manufacturers, and when we talk about manufacturers, we're talking about semiconductor companies. These are the guys that make the components for iPads, iPhones, everything.
So give me a couple of, I mean, we looked at, for example, a company called MIPS a few weeks ago. We bought it. Their earnings were stunk, and we said, you know what? We're going to see what happens moving forward. Smaller company. I mean, is there any what companies? I mean, you're talking about the memory companies, the ARM or whatever for the alternative. What are you talking about?
I mean, ARM is going to be in everything, and you're seeing that major move. I mean, Goldman's even behind it now, and ARM they say is the next Intel of the tablet industry. How Intel is like the PC play, but you know, again, MIPS technology is a good play. I to be honest with you, the two companies I just came out of my research today, and it's publishing, so I can't give you the two companies that I really really focused on. But numerous plays. Cypress Semiconductor, you could look at it as well. You also have the Skyworks and the TriQuint Semi who are going to be in the iTabs as well. Those companies are up tremendously. But these two companies that I recommended seem to have excellent balance sheets. And not only that, they don't have if you're not an Apple supplier, you have very little exposure to the tablet industry right now because it's in its infancy. So it's almost like a guessing game to if one of these companies or two or three of these companies get selected. I mean, look what happened to Arm Holdings where the company was 852 weeks ago. What is it, 27, 28? I mean, if these guys really start using the company's chips, they take off. So it's almost like a guessing game at this stage. But what you want to do is limit your risk. So make sure these companies have very, very good balance sheets and established businesses, maybe in PCs and in 3G phones and smartphones, which are growth markets. This way, you have limited risk in case they're not selected.
Right.
But make sure they have, they list their suppliers, and you know, it's not too difficult to find when you're doing your research in a semiconductor market. But there are a little differences.
Yeah, there's a few of them. I mean, Skyworks Solutions has been really neat to watch. MIPS, I do like that. It's a very small company, very liquid. We had a small piece of it. I was not impressed with their earnings numbers. We may look back to that if they start riding a little bit again. But they actually have an incredible relationship with Google and the Android system, I should say, or for the Android system. The problem is that they only make about, I think that the number we were looking for was like a $70 million revenue for the quarter, if I remember correctly. That's a small company.
Yeah, it's a small company. Plus, it's doing pretty well, too.
It's doing well. I'm not complaining about that. I'm just saying that the problem was that their last quarter, I was really disappointed with their numbers that came out and their outlook there. They should have beat by a lot more considering what was going on. Skyworks is great. Cypress Semiconductor has been, a really interesting play. And obviously, we're even seeing some of like you said, the lesser loved companies that have been kind of trailing off when they come out with a number on earnings that is even near close to what it is. I mean, the shorts that are in there are just getting squashed.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not even a squeeze. It's a squash.
And this is one thing that I would say is not really a trade. You got to be very careful. Some of these stocks have run up tremendously already, but I just think the tablet market in the U.S., a lot of people are talking about it. We know about it. I have an iPad, but it's just beginning. I mean, think about, the cell phone again. What is it? 500 million clients for China Telecom. 500 million cell phone users just for that one company. They have money to purchase these prices. Of course, you're not talking about 1.3 billion people, but still, if you talk about 100, 200 million people, 300 million people, that's almost like everybody in the U.S. owning a 3G phone or a tablet.
Yeah, amazing. All right, well, we look forward to seeing your research, and of course, you could visit and find out more about Frank Curzio's writings, and probably by the time you read this, it'll be out. On the tablets and some of the hardware manufacturers over at Stansberry Research. Of course, we'll put a link on the Discipline Investor blog, the show notes for this particular show. And then in about 4 weeks or so, where everybody needs their Frank Curzio fix, as I call it, we'll bring you back and we'll talk.
And also, my podcast listeners, SNA Investor Podcast, want the Andrew Horowitz fixes.
Oh,
well. So hopefully you'll get on pretty soon, because I get some great comments when you're on as well.
I appreciate that. It's awesome. So yeah, we'll definitely do that. And I hope that if you have any questions for Frank, of course, you could write him, write me, and make sure to go to iTunes and look up Frank Curzio, and you have to subscribe to his podcast as well. It's an awesome, awesome podcast. I love it. But his research is good also, his writing, and so Frank, we'll talk soon, buddy.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it, Andrew.
All right, bye-bye. All right, so now I thought we'd switch gears here and we'd talk about the unemployment situation with Barry Ritholtz from Fusion IQ, a great service that analyzes stocks and gives you a lot of good signals. A lot of people are always looking for good signals, and also has a great book out. You see him on CNBC and Bloomberg and all over the place. He's all over the place, which is great. Barry, it's been a while, my friend. Happy New Year.
I know. Happy New Year.
So talk to me a little bit about what happened this week. We saw the unemployment rate come out at 9%. Which I think was a shocker to most people, but we saw the increase in jobs at 36,000. Expectations were over 140. What's the story?
Well, two things. First, you had a pretty mediocre job number. Everybody's going to blame some of that on the weather, but the simple reality is the economy is not creating jobs, and that is not a surprise to those of us who look at the data. Here's the mistake that all the economists, the classical economists, make. They go back and they say, let's take a look at the set of all recoveries from recessions, and at this point after the recession is declared over, here's what we should be doing.
Right.
You know, the 2001 recession, where it took, I think the number was 47 months to get back to the same number of jobs. Gee, that was an aberration. And now here it is, and we're knowing near, you look at how long it's taking, we're probably going to take at least 47 months and probably closer to 60 to 70 months. But the reason for that is that set of recessions that the economists look at, those are your standard, typical, cyclical recessions. You know, the economy's doing well, it starts to running a little hot, the Fed raises rates, the economy corrects, the market corrects, you have an 8-month recession, the Fed lower rates, the demand for stuff takes off again, and then once again, the economy starts moving in the right direction and jobs are created. That is not what we had. The set that you should be looking at as a comparison is what happens when you have a major credit crisis and recession along with a market crash. What is the normal recovery like thereafter? And to me, the best data set for that is the Reinhardt and Rogoff book, This Time It's Different, 800 Years of Financial Crisis. And you see, as much as people are looking at this recession, this recovery, and saying, oh, the GDP is so slow, and oh, the jobs are so underperforming, this is so unexpected, actually it's not. When you have a credit crisis and you destroy a tremendous amount of capital, and the both corporate and private sector and government sector spend the next couple of years deleveraging, history shows us that GDP underperforms, you're way below capacity, job creation is mediocre, you barely keep, if you're lucky, you're barely keeping pace with population growth, which in the United States at over 300 million people is you have to have 125,000, 150,000 a month on average. We've seen, you know, a little somewhere near that over the past couple of months. This month clearly way below, and maybe 50 or 100,000 of that was weather-related. But this is what we're likely to see, and if history is a guide, we could see this for 5 years. You could see 50,000, 150,000, 200,000, and everybody gets excited, back to 75,000. The demand for jobs has not become significant yet, and the odds are that it's not likely to become significant in the immediate future. Maybe 6 months from now, maybe 2 years from now.
So here's the deal. I hate to say this, right? But then if we have the same jobs numbers that we've been seeing, which have been poor from a standard recovery, as we just talked about. So two things. Number one, well, who cares? The stock market doesn't seem to care. In fact, I have gone so far as saying that it's very clear that some of the reason the companies are doing well is because of the fact that there are no jobs. You know, there's not a lot of job creation.
That's absolutely. The good corporate earnings are driven by extreme productivity, high efficiency, low hiring, and outsourcing of jobs. There's no doubt that there's a correlation between bad employment and high corporate profits these days, at least in the firms that could move this stuff overseas.
Now, can that last forever? Seriously. I mean, really think about this.
Because, I don't know. You have to give the public enough money to go out and do stuff.
Right.
If the public doesn't have money to go out and spend, look, keep in mind, 90% of the labor force, 91% if you believe the data today, is gainfully employed. The bulk of that data today, let's talk about that before we forget. The reason we saw unemployment plummet isn't because all those people went out and got jobs. It's because all those people left the labor force, people who have been long-term employed, and there's a lot of people who plummeted from the labor force. You had 504,000 people drop out of the labor force.
Let me tell you what I just did. I'm not telling you this figuratively. I'm telling you this honestly. I just pulled the full report out of my garbage pail. Okay,
mm-hmm.
the employment report. I'm not kidding. Has some Coca-Cola on there from what I was recently drinking, but. You know, I look at this and two things happen from my understanding. Number one, people out of the labor force, number one. Number two, there's also some weird weather-related, like 800,000 people in non-ags were unable to work. And then the
right.
other point was they changed their methodology. Did you see this?
Well, yeah, but we knew that was coming. They announced that 3 months ago that this methodology change was coming. And by the way, normally when they change the methodology, it usually magically adds to what the numbers. This was the methodology change. Look, the birth-death adjustment has been completely misleading. It's actually, believe it or not, in the beginning of an economic recovery, the companies that are creating jobs, the BLS does a poor job tracking. That was the whole concept behind the birth-death adjustment in the first place. The problem is later in the cycle, those numbers are particularly inaccurate.
But what about this 9%, though? I mean, are we happy that it's 9%? And
no, you don't. You want to see that? Listen, the entire Bush administration low interest, unemployment rate, 03, 04, 05, 06. I was screaming the whole time. These are not people. We don't see the unemployment rate going down because people are getting jobs. The unemployment rate is going down because people are leaving the labor pool, and that was what was true under Obama. I'm sorry, under George Bush, and now we see the same thing true under Obama. You have long-term unemployed dropping out of the labor pool. You have the people who have been 99 weeks on unemployment, they're dropping out of the labor pool. You people who structurally, their jobs no longer exist in this country. If you work in a millery, if you used to do certain things with material and clothing and fabrics, you know, the huge percentage of those jobs have left the country where and have gone to places where people are making $5 a day or $2 a day. How could you compete with that in the United States?
Yeah, I hear you. But it does seem like, and I keep coming back to this, that I do scratch my head and wonder how much of importance, at least in the near term, that this unemployment situation is. We saw the ISM number come out on the manufacturing this week and the non-manufacturing come out. Those were both really hot. We saw, of course, Bernanke swear that there's no inflation. And what's really interesting about that is we have all this money being pushed into our economy through quantitative easing and all that, but there's no inflation. Yet, in Europe, they're really concerned about the inflation rate picking up and their inflation rate is showing up. But meanwhile, they're on austerity. It's a little bit weird.
You know, austerity is, you're raising two or three issues. And I think a lot of people get the underlying issues wrong. First, when we talk about austerity, you have to wonder why are people talking about austerity? Keynes actually got most of this right. I know a lot of right-wing guys like to bash Keynes. But it's clear that Milton Friedman got a lot of the deregulation stuff wrong, and people misunderstand what Keynes said. They actually get Keynes wrong. What Keynes said is, during a recession when the private sector stops spending, if the government steps in and replaces that, you'll modify the depths of the economic cycle and have a shorter, shallower recession. Now, Keynes also said, once the economy recovers, the government should step out of the way and let the private sector do what they're going to do. But in the reality is that's a difficult process. It's intellectually challenging. It's emotionally difficult. And most politicians have a really hard time with that. So I think the idea behind austerity is exactly ass backwards. When the private sector stops spending, you let the public sector step in and replace it, but only with the caveat that the government should be a counter-cyclical spender, meaning during a recession, they should be cutting taxes and increasing spending and running a deficit. During a boom time, they should be cutting spending and increasing taxes and running a surplus. But again, in order to do that, we would actually have to be mature adults and have an intelligent discussion about spending and taxes. And in the United States, anyway, our politicians are incapable of doing that. If anybody suggests a tax increase, the anti-tax lunatics tear their heads off. You should be cutting taxes during recession. You should be bringing them back to a normal level to pay for services during an expansion. It's very, very simple. Intellectually, it's easy to wrap your head around. No one wants to do that. The government should not be expanding during an expansion. What Bush did that was totally wrong was from 2003 to 2007, you had an expanding economy in large part caused by Greenspan. You had a booming stock market. That's when you raise taxes and cut services because the private sector can afford to step in and replace it. In fact, naturally, the private sector will step in and do that. Hey, they're more efficient than the government. But nobody ever does it that way. Politicians are really, really bad about that. And I think most of the small government anti-tax people misstate Keynes all the time because he pretty much agrees with them in a sophisticated way. Yes, of course, during an expansion, you should have smaller government, and the way you do that is reduce the services and increase the taxes, and you don't run a deficit, you run a surplus. Now, all this brings me to the second point, which is about deficits, and again, we have a core of politicians in D.C. who are hypocritical and you know, disingenuous. On my trading desk, we would say they're full of shit. I don't know if you could say that on a podcast, but...
Beep! Go ahead, next.
There you go. Here's the reality. I see these we call them deficit peacocks, these guys who come out, and they're against spending, they're against the deficit, and you pull up their track record. I actually posted this on the blog the other day. Here, go see how people voted on the Iraq war, on the tax cut, on the health care bill. If you voted in favor of a war of choice in Iraq that was unfunded and cost trillions of dollars, if you voted in favor of an unfunded tax cut, and as long as I mentioned Milton Friedman, let me quote Friedman, who said a tax cut that is not paid for with spending cuts is nothing more than a tax increase on your grandkids. If you voted for the 01 and 03 unfunded tax cuts, you are creating a deficit. And lastly, if you voted for that prescription drug entitlement program, you created a deficit. So I look at these guys who are all posturing against the deficit today, and I look at their voting record, and you say, these guys are just partisan jackasses. Why should anybody listen to them? Now, Pete Peterson is an exception. He's a guy who's been railing about the deficit, whether a Democrat or Republican has been in office. He's been on this for 15 years. I give him, you know, full props for that. But 90% of the guys in D.C. who are supposed deficit hawks, they're not. They're peacocks. They're full of crap. And to me, the last thing you want to do when the economy is not stable, when you're not creating jobs, is go to austerity. And don't believe my viewpoint. Just look at England and look at Ireland. They're the poster child for, hey, cut your spending, reduce taxes, do all this stuff, go into austerity. And their economies are all in the crapper, probably as bad as the U.S., if not worse.
But, you know, at the end of the day, Barry, what was really fascinating is that I know that you track all of the economics, and I do as well, and it's kind of like you got to wonder that for example, in England, I mean, their stock market seems to be just all happy-go-lucky. There's no correlation with the economy right now,
never
or at least
been.
The outlook. Yeah,
never
I
has
mean,
been.
The
you know,
yeah.
Frequently the stock market totally decouples from the economy. I mean, look at 99-2000. It went off the rail. Look at 2003-2007. That whole artificial, ultra-low rates, ultra-leverage situation, if the market really was paying attention to what was going on, the market would say, hey, you know, we really shouldn't be screaming higher here because this is a debacle waiting to happen. And yet the market doubled from...
late 2002, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
To 2007
so. 03 to 07, and now from March 2009... here's the joke. Everybody who screams about deficits are so bad for the economy. If you believe the market is telling you what's going on, markets love deficits because it's just additional stimulus spending.
Yeah, it's free
Reagan
money.
Created
exactly.
Huge deficits, huge market rally. Bush
right.
Created huge deficits from 03 to 07, huge market rally. Obama inherited the problem, but he made it worse with his situation, with his stimulus spending and his tax cuts and everything else, huge market rally. The market likes a big deficit because all that deficit spending is stimulative. I know that's
right.
Very counterintuitive and contrary, but the data doesn't lie.
You know, it's totally logical, in fact. In fact, I'll go one step further. What I've kind of been looking at lately is how brilliant, in a way, the Bernanke QE2 is in that it is a totally arbitrary amount that comes to be used throughout the week, you know, in buying various bills, bonds, treasuries at different lengths. And you know what I think is interesting is, you know, how when the market dips down, you know, who knows, maybe they really pound on the buying, push down the dollar potentially with the amount. Maybe instead of an $8 billion buy, they do a $20 billion buy, a $15 billion. Maybe things are going fine, they buy $2 or $3 billion, and they can actually do a lot of kind of psychological warfare with the markets to keep it propped up over time with that $600 billion.
Do you remember the whole mental recession discussion? I think it was June 08 when Phil Graham came out and said, you know, the economy really isn't bad. Everybody just has
yeah.
a mental recession.
Right. I remember that.
You know,
yeah.
The public, on the other hand, the public knew exactly what the story was. And when you surveyed people, they said, we're in a recession. And no, we're not, everybody said. And people, first of all, the stock market is a terrible gauge of the economy, not just because it decouples so often. But in the United States, and by the way, this is a truth that people don't like to hear, but it's the reality. The vast majority of equities are held by a tiny percentage of Americans. 90% of the 306 million Americans have little or no equities. And if you look at the median, according to the I think it's the Z1 Fed flow of funds report that comes out, it's something like $25,000 or $30,000. It's nothing. The top 1% has something like 50% of the equities. The top 10 or 15% is something like 70%. So the stock market is a real bad read on the overall economy. It's a bad read on a number of factors. But for many people, it's the only thing that that really seems to matter.
Right. And the unemployment rate for that matter also. So, but I guess the point is, would you agree with one thing? I think that, you know, this whole process of low rates and the ability for companies to refinance their debt and keep off, you know, low amount of overhead due to the scare they
have. It's a huge advantage to them.
Huge,
absolutely.
Right? Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no, it's 100. It's a fantastic advantage to them. It's something that it hurts savers. It hurts the elderly. It hurts lots and lots of people. But look, what did IBM do a recent refinance?
Oh, it was ridiculous. I think it was 75
bips. 1%. Yeah.
It was ridiculous. Right. But there's a second part of it too. It's not just a one-time hit. It's a long-term benefit because they're not going to go out and they're not going to go out and say, you know what, we want to buy those bonds back. I mean, they're going to let those things mature. There's
that's
no way.
That's exactly right. I mean, what are they going to refinance it at half a percent?
Right. There's no way.
It's absolutely. And you know, I'll tell you something fascinating. As bad as as the state of deleveraging is with both the government at the federal level, states and municipalities, and the average American family, corporate America has never had a better balance sheet. Their books have never been cleaner. You know, their accounting, you can say some of their accounting is a little fishy, but post-WorldCom and Enron, it's better than it was beforehand.
Yep,
they're carrying less debt that they have, and the debt they're carrying is at such a ridiculously low rate. Corporate America is in really good shape. It's unfortunate that they're just really not hiring.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, Barry Ritholtz again from you can go to Ritholtz. He has a blog, great blog. It used to be called The Big Picture. Now it's just
still called The Big Picture.
But you get there different ways. Just look up The Big Picture.
Ritholtz.com, easy enough to find.
Ritholtz.com, we'll put a link on it. Also, he's got a book out. What's the name? Tell us.
Bailout Nation. Now in paperback.
Oh, very nice. Kindle edition too and all that, I'm sure,
yep,
as well
yep,
as the fact
absolutely.
That he manages money and he's on TV. Your mother should fell.
But can I tell you something? I say this all the time. The fact that someone's on TV is the last reason you should take them seriously.
Oh,
you've done enough media that you know you know, there are a handful of people I listen to who are occasionally on TV, and I'm like, that guy's pretty smart, and there's an awful lot of them who just couldn't think their way out of a wet paper bag.
Yep, exactly. And then you have to realize, who's booking them as well, what they're looking for and the angles they're looking for. So we'll leave it at that and not stir the pot.
All right, listen,
buddy.
Take care, Andrew. Have a good weekend.
All right, you too. Bye-bye. All right, there's a couple other things I wanted to talk about. And one of the things I want to remind you is that we have, I guess in 2 weeks, we're going to have the call-in show. So, you know, if you have any questions that you'd like to ask, we've got a lot of them come in so far, but if you have any questions that you'd like to ask at all and you wanted to, you know, come on the podcast, do yourself a favor, very simply, all you have to do is email askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Give me your name, your telephone number, and also provide your question, your topic, just something that you want to talk about so we can kind of screen out and make sure we don't have a lot of duplicates. And send that to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we'll get you going on that. What I wanted to discuss was the culmination of the conversations that we have been going over the last few weeks and recently about the economic numbers in the United States, the disparity we see a little bit when it comes to some of the other emerging nations and what to make of some of this, and then how to read some of these earnings numbers that we're seeing, and to follow through with, you know, now what do you do? Well, first of all, I think we need to recognize that whatever the reason, whatever you want to blame on it or you want to cheer about, the fact is that the economic numbers in the United States and for the most part around the world are clearly in, I would call past recovery state right now into a growth level. Now, it's obvious that there's some discrepancy and there's some argument and disagreement when it comes to what's going on around the world, because a lot of people would say, well, you know, this is a government-generated recovery, and it's not sustainable. And, you know, that's fine. Call it what we may. But the fact of the matter is that what are we here to do? We're here to invest, right? Okay. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to get it right all the time. I mean, that doesn't mean your stock that you like, that you picked for whatever reason and that you have, is going to play along. It doesn't mean that you're going to get it right when it comes to buying or selling or shorting or covering or anything of that nature. But what I'm saying to you is that when you look at, well, I guess this quarter compared to last quarter, or even look at this, the last few quarters, and you compare that to about 2 years ago, there's clearly a change, and it's clearly showing up in the corporate earnings releases, the conference calls, a lot more confidence that is coming out from conference calls, and there's a lot more, as you've seen, higher prices paid in the merger and activity space. Just last week, we saw that there will be two steel companies that will be the major steel companies in Japan that will be joining forces in order to, first of all, clearly save on overhead because there's a lot of duplication there. And they see that they can make a lot more money together overall due to the escalating steel prices and, you know, the ability to really ramp up production. You also see that when you look around and you see that the chemical companies are raising prices, that means that they are able to pass that on at least to their buyers. You know, you get companies like a DuPont or a Dow Chemical or an Albemarle. They are doing a great job of passing that on. Now, obviously, there's so much. There's only a point that we can say that, okay, that's going to be something that can be passed on and it's acceptable. Because after a certain point, you have to realize that it does trickle down. It also, we have to realize that margins get pressured. We've talked about this. Right now, we're on the edge of it. We're just on the edge of when margins will see some pressure starting to develop. Even though there is the conversation that is going on, you know, the differences of what is inflation, what is the real inflation number, and what is not, it is very, very clear that inflation is showing up in all sorts of measures around the world. We're not going to get into that debate because we can look at it any way that we want to. We can look at it from just a domestic U.S. space. We can look at it the European situation. Even Europe, by the way, even Europe has shown to have inflation that is ticking up. So it's remarkable and almost amazing that the United States doesn't have it. But that's a topic for a different time. But when we look at earnings right now and we look at the corporate environment and the revenues, generally speaking, the truth is that what you're finding is that many companies have been able to leverage themselves, clean themselves up, and do a really good job up until this point from the point where it was, you know, down low. Maybe it was a lesson they learned. You know, we can look at this a lot of different ways. Maybe it was a lesson they learned of how they were just spending and growing and leveraging, and they were really getting too fat and complacent back in the mid-2000s into 2007, 2008, et cetera. And they have the, and maybe that's kind of like what happened to you and I, maybe. You know, we said, oh, well, you know, things are good and we could spend freely. And then all of a sudden, well, back in 2008, everybody seemed to have shut their wallets. Maybe that's exactly what happened also when we fast forward in the corporate world, when they realized, you know what, we can't do that anymore. I don't know if you've had any epiphanies. A lot of people I know have, where they said, you know what, we realize what happens. We realize when we get over leveraged and we spend too much and we borrow on the house and we spend beyond our means at such an extraordinary level that it really could bite us in the backside one of these days. Now, realize, let's be honest. Let's talk honestly. The truth of the matter is that lasts only so long, right? Things get better. And then all of a sudden, people, just generally, just the nature of the beast, fall back into bad habits. Well, it can't happen again, we could say, or maybe, you know, if it does, look at the great amount of stimulus power that the government has to save us, and they won't let anything happen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think when you look at that, you have to realize that right now we're in a really kind of the pinnacle, the peak of what may be excellence in corporate earnings. That doesn't mean they can't earn more. I'm saying in terms of the way they've structured their overall expenses and their you know, their revenue streams to give you and give us one of the best looks at net income that we can see. So for right now, we're still seeing the continuation of many companies, particularly in the technology area, really ramping up their abilities to not only consult but provide software. We talked about Frank with the hardware situation when it comes to iPads, iTouches, the Samsung Galaxies, all the different tablets, the laptops, etc. So I think that the focus on technology innovation and the continuation of the fact that there is a lot more production happening. We saw the manufacturing numbers coming. Both the ISM numbers came in last week. Both of them came in very high, which means that manufacturing and the non-manufacturing number, the service number, both were very, very strong. That's very good to see. They're in expansionary mode. Now, I took the way that the same indices were being read back in 2008, 2009 to mean I took them the way that they were being explored, exploited, and I guess reported on. I had some problems with that, and I'll tell you why. Oftentimes, what you see is a with these indices in particular, an over 50 and under 50 number. So over 50 is expansion, under 50 is contraction. And what was happening was, I'm just picking a number, we're down to the 20s or so, 30s. Went from 30 to 35, then to 37, then to 32, you know, negative I'm talking about. On the negative side of the 50, in other words, under 50. So you went from let's say 37 to 38. 39, and then what was happening is we were in the less bad, less bad, less bad, less bad. That was good. You know, that potentially could lead to an expansionary phase. But that doesn't always happen. You have to realize that when you start rolling over is where the concern happens. And that happened, by the way, last year. That happened in the mid part of last year. We saw a variety of indices that were all based on not only manufacturing, but on the non-service or the services area starting to roll over, and markets took notice. And it really wasn't until that gigantic push of money in by the Fed, and then the additional, I guess we'll call it stimulus at this point, the additional ability for the fiscal stimulus that was done in the way of a payroll tax reduction. The fear was gone about having to have excessive taxes because, of course, they let that expire or, you know, didn't let that expire, the Bush tax cuts. So all these things put together really helped. If you look at retail sales, were enormous. Some of the companies that we hold have just, it's like, wow, look at these numbers. Very impressive. And I think that for many of the naysayers of looking back on it, I think that it's really important for all of us to really re-question what we're looking at and how we're looking at things right now, because until this rolls over, if it ever does, okay, so I'm not saying it will or won't, but until it rolls over, why not at least look at it as, you know, without the rearview mirror of looking at what happened in 2007 through 2009 partials, okay, that time period. You know, look at it with fresh eyes. Take a moment to step back and look at a stock. Don't look at where it was. Look at where it's been, where it's going. Kind of like you would when you're driving, right? You're not going to look in the rearview mirror constantly. You look in there to make sure nobody's going to come up behind you and hit you. But at the same time, you know, look at the individual equities, the markets, with fresh eyes. You know, like if you didn't know what happened, and your portfolio wasn't really in trouble back then if it happened. So just a commentary right now in the beginning of the year, something to think about, something to consider, something that we always look at as something that we want to make sure that we're doing. It doesn't always work. You know, a lot of times you have to say, oh, you know, this stock, we talked about Power One a little while ago, you know, this stock bit us then, and it bit, you know, we don't want to look at it right now for a while because we have a concern over what management has done. And you know, until they show us something different, we're not going after that stock again. And so consider that as just a quick lesson in awareness of what is going on in the markets and how you should maybe operate, you know, when it comes to that. The other thing that I'll mention to you is in closing that we do have some great guests coming up. Jim Rogers in a few weeks. His schedule just got really crazy. We went back and forth a few times on email. We also going to have Tom McClellan come back. We want to talk to him. Terry Bedford is coming up soon. We have lots of great people that are going to be on. If you have anybody that you want to hear that may be a good idea, do me a favor. Just send me a note. Always to askandrew@thedisciplineinvestor.com, and we'll see what we can do about that. And we'll see if we can get them on. But the final point that I think that I wanted to bring up is that, you know, that I think that it's going to be really interesting to see what the outcome is over the next couple of weeks with this whole situation in the Middle East and how that affects or does not affect our markets. And I think that's going to be the telltale sign of what really investors are thinking in a big picture here. And if, you know, if there is any hiccups in the markets that will be sustainable, because as it seems right now, the volumes have been pretty light on the up days, and there was pretty much light on the down days. So right now, there's not a lot of conviction, even though the markets are, you know, slowly creeping higher. And even on down days, there's been the bias towards, you know, bring it up. And the same thing holds true for many individual stocks. When you see them dropping off, there's been a bit of a bid on the buy side. So until that changes, you know, that's what it is. You know, just remember that. Until next time, I hope you join me on the next episode. This is episode number 198 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I hope you had some interesting thoughts that you can provide me for some questions for our 200th show. And if not, I'll see you next week anyway with a great guest, great commentary, and some great ideas. Thanks for joining me again. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.